The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
From policy to culture, principles to politics, this is the Seth Leibson Show.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour three. It's a delight to bring back an old friend, one of my longest time friends, probably third longest friend my whole entire life, Tevi Troy. He is a presidential and cultural historian, author of several books, most recently Fight House Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. See his writings and commentary, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times. You even see his letters in The Wall Street Journal. Tevi Troy, welcome back to the airwaves of Phoenix.
Thanks for having me, Seth. And I appreciate you mentioning my Murphy book, but as you know, I have a book coming this summer in August on Presidents and CEOs, The Power and the Money. So we'll get to start talking about that one soon, too.
Yeah, it might even have some relevance for the State of the Union, which I want to talk to you about from your perch as a historian. But I have a lot I want to do with you, if that's okay. Can we cover the vast territory that is the fertile mind of Tevi Troy?
Amen. I look forward to it.
Okay. First of all, this will be interesting to the audience. You have been going around the country as an observant and as a religiously observant but politically conservative member of the Jewish faith, Jewish man, debating a reform rabbi who is politically liberal in various venues, various fora around the country. I think you had a debate, if I'm not mistaken, last night in New York City with him. And I raise it because, Tevi, the question, gosh knows you've been dealing with it your whole life as I have, but the question I get so often, especially in these times, is why are Jews so wedded to the Democratic Party? Say anything you want about the debate, but maybe weave in an answer or an attempted answer to that question, too, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I am doing this series of debates with Rabbi Saperstein, who is a dear friend, but we just disagree politically. And I think when I think about what he says and what I say, I think he just has a deep and abiding faith in the federal government to solve problems. And I see the way that the federal government creates problems. When they decide you should get something and you shouldn't, he sees that as benefiting a certain community. I see that as potentially taking away from someone. So I think that's really at the heart of it. The key question of the debate is liberalism or conservatism better for the Jewish community and for America? And my argument throughout is that Jewish faith is designed to conserve itself, and that is at the heart of conservatism. We pass on our tradition from generation to generation, and how do you do that? You marry, you have children, you teach the tradition to your children so that they can pass it on as well. And I think we do that with the American tradition as well. We teach about the founders and we teach about the great American institutions because we want to perpetuate this great system that, as I've talked about on the show before, is really the essence of it is what Ronald Reagan said, which is liberty binds us together. We are not a demographic group or a racial group or an ethnic group. We are a bunch of people who've come together who believe in the system of liberty. And I think that's at the heart of this disagreement that we have.
It is at the heart of it, and that's well stated. And the question that would follow that up would be, if there are two countries that in the history of the world have proven to be the most safe, protecting of, and fertile for prosperity of Jews, it would be of obviously modern Israel and the United States of America, thus raising the question, if that is true, if that is the given, how do Jews vote liberal, vote Democrat? How do they do it? Why do they do it?
Well, first of all, the word conservatism has a bad reputation from the European context, where conservatism means to conserve the feudalist or monarchist tradition, which was not good to the Jews.
Yeah.
And the Jews wanted liberalism in that they wanted liberation from the ghettos and from the monarchist systems that often use the Jews as a scapegoat.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is carryover from the European context. But then also, I mean, the federal government has been a force for good in some things when it was much smaller and I think much less focused on picking winners and losers. And so the bigger it gets and the more focused it is on picking winners and losers, their externalities and all these great things you want the federal government to accomplish, they come with costs. And I think that I tend to see the costs. And Rabbi Saperstein looks at more at the benefits and doesn't acknowledge the cost as much.
Interesting. Okay. Final question on this point, unless you want to go further or add anything to it. I was listening on my drive into Dennis Prager this morning, and he was making a point he's made many times before in talking about the attack on conservatives generally, irrespective of religious identification, as comes from the Democratic Party, as comes from Joe Biden, that conservatives are anti-democracy and pro-fascist. They are a threat to democracy. They are a party of fascism and fear. That's what the chairman of the DNC has said about our party. Dennis was making the point generally, and you could do this any number of ways, but how is it possible that a movement that wants less government is the party of less democracy and more fascism? There is a relationship to that here in the Jewish part. I said this was irrespective of faith, but now let me make it respective of faith. There is an element here that the state is, shall I say, the overwhelming size of a state, of a country, of a government, is really the first threat to religious minorities, typically, isn't it?
Well, certainly, and that's how I see it. And look, I think there is a long and unhappy tradition of liberals calling anything they don't like or their opposition fascist.
Right.
And our friend Jonah Goldberg wrote that book about liberal fascism, where the accusation isn't always apt, and sometimes the fascism is coming from the left, and there's not a recognition in that. So I think the word fascism is just often misused. I think another word that is being misused these days, and Rabbi Saperstein was throwing this word out a lot, is Christian nationalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And I argued that it seems in the mainstream media that anytime somebody says, I believe our rights come from God, and you are an expert in natural law, and I'm interested in natural law, anytime anybody says that formulation, the media tends to dismiss them as Christian nationalists. And I think that is at the essence of our system, that our rights come from God, but we've created a constitutional system to allow us to enjoy and inhabit those rights.
Yeah, it is what has made our country, the American founding, the best regime, the disestablishment, but it can only happen with an understanding, as Jefferson wrote into the very document that we were founded upon, that we are founded based on rights that can only come from the laws of nature and nature's God. Yeah, I mean, the idea that the idea that Thomas Jefferson is a Christian nationalist, I mean, if that's Christian nationalism, hook me up.
Right. So I think that phrase is misused these days. Rabbi Saperstein says he's basing it on opinion polls. We happen to disagree on that. I see it is a frequent trope in the liberal media. They try and dismiss any conservative who says, I believe that our rights come from God, as some kind of crazy Christian nationalist. And I think that's just part of the American tradition. I don't think it's at all crazy or Christian nationalist.
It's interesting how Christian nationalism replaced white nationalism. I don't know what to do with that quite yet. It must pull better inside liberal or left-wing precincts, because for about 6 years the threat was white nationalism. And you're right to point out now it's of a sudden Christian nationalism. Kind of an interesting transference, isn't it?
Well, I think there's also the overuse of an appellation or criticism. It diminishes it.
Yeah,
it lowers it down.
Yeah.
It dilutes it. So for years, every Republican was called racist.
Yeah.
And, you know, it lost its meaning when you said that Mitt Romney and John McCain, who are manifestly not racist, are racist. So then you have to up the game. And then you say, well, they're not racist, they're white nationalists.
Right.
So you keep upping the game in terms of the new accusations that you throw at the right. I mean, I think it's an ugly and unpleasant game, but I think that is what happens.
You want a nice phrase for that? You'll like this. Syntactical saturation. Isn't that nice? Syntactical saturation. The overuse, obviously, the overuse Whereas, you know, applying the economic rules of inflation to our verbiage, such that you diminish the currency of the term by overuse of it. Syntactical saturation. All right, Mr. Bill is telling me I've got to take a commercial break. Let's do that. I want to talk to you also about a piece you had in the Washington Examiner of all the other publications. I neglected to mention that one, but it's an interesting one. And we'll get to the State of the Union. Dr. Tevi Troy is my guest. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Dr. Tevi Troy is my guest. T-E-V-I is his first name. T-R-O-Y his last name. His most recently published book, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. Author of any number of books and an upcoming book coming out this summer, The Power and the Money, The Epic Clashes Between American Titans of Industry and Commanders in Chief. Can't wait for that. That'll be great summer reading, Tevi. Congrats on that, by the way.
Thank you.
In that Mr. Bill is producing us today, I know no two people who like and love baseball more. Do you guys have any baseball talk you want to interject into this, our culture segment of the show, or are we good to move on?
Bill, I'm going to wait for the season to start, but I did want to make one more point about the rabbi.
Yeah, debate. Please.
Because I know, and I listen to your Rabbi Alish conversations,
yeah.
And I do appreciate them. I know he's not on today.
Yeah.
So at the end of the debate, the rabbi of the synagogue that was hosting us asked a very interesting question.
Yeah.
And it said, in what text of the Jewish tradition do you root your perspective, liberalism for Rabbi Saperstein and conservatism for me?
Uh-huh.
And I spoke about Deuteronomy 5:5, which is my favorite biblical verse if I were a presidential candidate and they were asking me. And it is... those that cleave to the Lord, they still are with us today.
Yeah.
I'm just translating in my head from the Hebrew, so I apologize if it's not the exact King James translation. But that verse speaks to me about the essence of Judaism, which is to conserve itself and to pass on its traditions from generation to generation. And by sticking with the Lord, that is why the Jewish people are still here today, and you don't walk down the street and see a Hittite or an Assyrian,
yeah.
Even though those were powerful empires back in the day. And what I said then is that the American tradition, the American experiment, has allowed Jews to carry on that tradition, to continue to perpetuate themselves and to pass on their traditions while at the same time integrating into this great American polity. And that is really what informed my thinking and why I am a conservative.
That's nice. Is it unfair to ask you what Dr. Saperstein said?
I'd have to leave it to him to say.
Okay, fair enough. I'll tell you my verse.
Written
by King David, Psalm 97. Those who love the Lord hate evil. Love God, hate evil.
A lot of similarities between our verses.
Yeah. I actually thought, exactly right. Psalm 97. Okay, well, this also is kind of a crossroads of culture and politics. Your Washington.
I'm sorry. Can I just say it's Deuteronomy 4:4, not 5:5. Deuteronomy 4:4.
You know the Jack Kemp story, right?
Please tell me.
He was speaking, I think it was to the Christian Coalition, and he cited something, I think it was from Deuteronomy, and someone in the audience yelled out, it's Leviticus, and he, without missing a beat, shouted back, same author!
Great story.
Yeah. Have you not heard that? Have we not done that before?
All right. No, I heard a great Jack Kemp story. If you have
yeah, sure, we always have room for Jack Kemp here.
He was a tennis player and a very competitive one.
Yeah.
And a heck of an athlete, as a former football player.
Yeah.
But he would hire as his body men people who were athletes who could play tennis with him.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes when you do that, they are better than you.
Yeah.
One particular body man beat Jack Kemp on the tennis court on one of their trips.
Oh, really?
And Jack Kemp was so mad that he had the plane take off without this poor person who was left on the tarmac holding his tennis racket.
Do we know who that person was?
I'm not going to say anything.
Okay. All right. Fine. You know the trick Ronald Reagan played on Bill Bennett? It was more of a joke, but they were somewhere in the middle of Nowheresville in the presidential limousine and entourage, and Reagan asked Bill if he would step outside before they rolled into town. He wanted to test the public address system from the limousine. You know this story? And,
no, but I can tell where it's going.
Yeah. And Bill stepped out to do it, and the Reagan entourage on Reagan's command went forward about, I don't know how many feet, but took off enough to think that Bill was being stranded there.
That's a great story.
All right. Well, we went from Bill Bennett and Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp. Let's go to Dan Quayle a second. Piece you have in the Washington Examiner, Dan Quayle reconsidered. The former vice president could even be a model for the 2024 running mate pick. Talk to us about this.
Right. So obviously everybody knows that Dan Quayle has this bad reputation, and Lloyd Benson said that demeaning thing about him in the debate, that you're a Jack Kennedy, and he misspelled potato, even though the card he was given had the word potato misspelled. So he sort of has a reputation as a lightweight. But he was actually a very serious student of policy, expert in domestic and foreign policy, represented the Bush administration that he served very well on TV. And it just occurred to me when I was reading something about Kamala Harris and her difficulties and her awkwardness that Dan Quayle was actually a heck of a vice president. And what hurt him more than anything else, and I lay this out in the piece and why it's relevant now, was the poor outreach that they did and the poor announcement of his selection that kind of left him looking like a deer in the headlights. And I argue in the piece that maybe there were some rivals within the Bush camp who were partially responsible for that, but he really never recovered from that poor announcement. And that to the extent that Donald Trump was looking for a vice president and wants to announce it with great fanfare at some point between now and the convention, he should really look what happened with Quayle to make sure that they don't make the same mistake.
I remember the very moment. It was, if I'm not mistaken, New Orleans, and Dan Quayle jumps on stage, I think without a jacket, I think with rolled up shirt sleeves, and was really acting the role of something like a cheerleader, if I'm not mistaken, on a not the most formal stage one would imagine. Is my memory roughly right?
Yeah, your memory is roughly right. And if you think about it, you wanted to imbue this person with gravitas.
Right.
Maybe you shouldn't have done the rolled up sleeve and the tie list. Now, you know, I like it when a president, you know, toward the end of the campaign does take off his tie and tries to relate to the American people. But that's not introducing yourself to the American people.
Yeah.
Right? By that point, you're already introduced to the American people. You want to show yourself in a less formal light. I think you need to start Quayle off in a different way.
Yeah. Will Quayle's memory in the history books go down, Dan Quayle's memory in the history books go down on the fight over fatherlessness in America and as the ultimate victor in that, or will it be written by the liberals?
It's a great question, because I think it's manifestly clear that
Everyone knows
the
this
Atlantic,
now, right, yeah.
The Atlantic magazine acknowledged in a famous headline, Dan Quayle was right.
Barbara
but
Defoe
I think the culture today is very hostile to this idea that intact families are the best way of avoiding poverty and passing on the tradition.
Yeah.
And so the hostility of the culture, I think, still makes them sneer at Quayle, even though he is manifestly right. And Rabbi Saperstein and I actually talked in the debate, and this is my point, about the success sequence. And what's the success sequence? And it comes from the Liberal Brookings Institution, not from conservative Terry Jordan. The success sequence says finish high school, have kids after you marry, and stay full-time employed. And that is the way to avoid poverty in this great country.
We get that from the Brookings Institution. Tevi, let me take a quick commercial break and get your thoughts on the State of the Union. Dr. Tevi Troy is my guest. He is the author of the upcoming book, The Power and the Money, The Epic Clashes Between American Titans of Industry and Commanders-in-Chief. His most recent book of many, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House, From Truman to Trump. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, coming to you from the 960 Patriot Broadcast Studios, which are brought to you by the veteran-owned Midas Gold Group, your trusted source for precious metals, trusted source for great political, historical, and cultural analysis is Dr. Tevi Troy. Tevi, let's talk a little bit about the State of the Union. Ben Domenech wrote famously, now it's been everywhere, the worst State of the Union in history. Was more Thunderdome than State of the Union, according to Ben Domenech. Your takes, in a historical context, if you prefer, rather than modern or whatever you want.
I think it's very interesting, Seth, the world we live in now, which is so divided into conservative perspectives and liberal perspectives. Obviously, that's always been the case to some degree. But if you read the conservative press, this is the worst, ugliest, most partisan State of the Union ever. And if you read the liberal or mainstream press, Joe Biden hit it out of the park.
Right.
It was a home run. He did a fantastic job.
Right.
And I'm struggling to figure out how to square that circle.
Yeah.
It's not just that the liberal media is in the tank for Biden, although they are. there's more to it than that. I think we just look at the world through different lenses these days. And I was really shocked at this differential. That usually there's some alignment between what the liberals and conservatives say. Maybe it's the flip side of the same coin. The liberals like that he was kind of angry and animated, and the conservatives didn't like it. But here, it was just two different universes looking at a speech that could have been given by two different people on two different days. So I think it really speaks to the divide in how the different sides in this country see every media event before them.
Yeah, say a little bit more about that, because, you know, I had been following the dichotomy between how the liberals were covering it, the liberal left was covering it, and how we were analyzing it on the conservative side. A lot of people were making a point of how Joe Biden went after the Supreme Court. Not the first time. My memory is that that had been done before. By Barack Obama, yeah, maybe even more acerbically. So there's a slight memory problem. Not to say that the norm is acceptable. I'm still upset over Nancy Pelosi physically and literally shredding Donald Trump's State of the Union speech on national or international television. These things have become. More and more, is the right word, acerbic? Certainly bitter comes to mind, but they have become that, haven't they?
More of a partisan spectacle, yeah. Is how I would say it. Yeah. And by the way, I've got to give a brief shout out to Speaker Johnson, who I thought was respectful throughout, which I think is the only way to play this.
Right.
There's no point in making faces at the president or being rude to the president. He's the president of the United States, and we may disagree with him, as I do and as you do. But when you are the Speaker of the House, you treat him with respect, and I think Johnson did that. It should be credited for that.
I did my own analysis earlier in the show on much of the State of the Union. As I read it, I actually only watched excerpts, but I read the State of the Union just because I, for a lot of reasons I won't go into. I just didn't want to ruin my night. That's mostly what it was about, to be honest with you. And
can I make a point on this quickly?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I am as you know, I teach at Yeshiva University this year, and I have a bunch of students, and we were talking about the State of the Union, and none of them, even though I have a class on the presidency, none of them were watching it live. They all said, I'm going to watch it later on double speed.
Well,
and that's how the youth watches things these days. They watch it on YouTube, and they up the speed so they don't have to sit there for, you know, the long applauses the pregnant pauses.
I don't know how you can watch that speech of Biden's on double speed. That would be like listening to Ben Shapiro on triple speed the way that thing went off last night, the way he was speaking. I don't know. Maybe that is the better way to listen to it. It just comes out as so much garrulousness or so much so much piffle. I don't know. But, you know, I was just the reason I didn't. I mean, part of it is because, look, I just think there's too much politics in one sense. But I also think that we, in some respects, make too much of it. Whatever credit Biden brought to himself or nerd to himself last night by actually getting through a speech late at night, no less, and for an hour, no less. It's going to be gone by tomorrow. This is not a durable moment. This was not, there was nothing said that was important or durable. And I don't think its lasting duration will be durable. Let me take a break. We can pick up on that when we come right back. Tevi Troy is my guest, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Dr. Tevi Troy is my guest, political and cultural historian, author of several books on American history and the presidency particularly, and he has a new one coming out in August. Be on the lookout for it, The Power and the Money, the epic clashes between American titans of industry and commanders in chief. I went through a few different things in the in the State of the Union of Joe Biden's last night, Tevi. But I thought I'd throw this at you because I know it's fresh on your mind. You've traveled to Israel a many number of times. You were probably debating policy with respect to Israel last night in your debate last night. And I thought the both sides-ism of Joe Biden's last night was interesting, particularly in the context of there being no both sides-ism when it became when it came to Russia and Ukraine. I wonder if you picked up on that as well.
Well, I don't think there should be both sides of them with Russia and Ukraine.
I agree. Yeah, no, we're on the same page there. Right.
With Israel and Gaza and Hamas.
Right.
But I think it's really interesting. You mentioned that the speech went an hour long and then Biden was up way past his bedtime.
Yeah.
The speech ended at 10:30 Eastern time.
Right.
Right. It's supposed to begin at 9 o'clock Eastern time.
Right.
Which would suggest that it was 90 minutes and the longest State of the Union ever.
Right.
But it started almost 20 minutes late.
Right.
Do you know why it started 20 minutes late?
I'm guessing because of the protests.
Yes, it started late because of pro-Hamas protests that prevented the President of the United States from getting to the State of the Union on time. And I am really sick of the media kind of ignoring this, that these pro-Hamas protesters are defacing property, they are snarling traffic, they are tearing down American flags on Veterans Day. And this, I believe in the First Amendment, but this is not the way to protest. There should be consequences to the way these people are protesting, the way they are violating the norms of civil debate. And I think that needs to be noted. And so then Biden gets up there and doesn't even acknowledge what's been done to him and the delay in terms of him getting there. And then he engages in this, I think, egregious both sides of him, when it's pretty clear that this war ends tomorrow if Hamas gives back the hostages and surrenders.
Yes. Yes, of course. Of course. By the way, American hostages, six American hostages, by the way, right
and
now.
And 30 Americans dead.
Right.
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 Imagine if 30 Americans died and six were taken hostage in Mauritania or Spain or any place on earth.
Right.
There would be outrage. But because it's in Israel, people seem to overlook it or even celebrate it. Like that guy who said on the Cornell campus, my alma mater, unfortunately, that he was exhilarated by the Hamas attacks.
Right.
So it just makes me mad that there is not an acknowledgement of the way these pro-Hamas protesters are violating the norms of debate. The pro-Hamas people, or the Hamas themselves, are violating the norms of warfare and civility and humanity and everything else you can imagine, acting in barbaric ways. And we just aren't calling it out the way it should be called out.
Tevi, political hat
Sorry
on.
Sorry for getting animated.
No, it's fine. Political hat on that point. Does he see those protests so strongly that they can block him from the State of the Union 20 minutes and have that added into his concern that he has a problem with the Democratic Party or the left, the base of the Democratic Party and the left on this issue?
So I don't know if he physically saw the protests, but I have to assume if the President of the United States is coming 20 minutes late to the State of the Union because of pro-Hamas protesters, somebody told him that that's the reason, even if he didn't actually see them.
Right.
And when it comes to protests who are getting in the way of a president, I have to tell one of my favorite stories about Ronald Reagan. This is when he was governor of California. And there were all these radical protesters back in those days, and they were holding up these signs saying, "We are the future." And Reagan asks the car to stop, and he scribbles something on a piece of paper, and he holds up the piece of paper so that they can see it, and it says, "I'm selling my bond."
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to divest my bond, something like that, right? Yeah, yeah. I was reminding the audience, speaking
unlikely of Biden would ever do that.
Right, of course. I was reminding the audience, or speaking with the audience yesterday, that one of my favorite dictionaries growing up was a 1965 American Heritage Dictionary published by Harcourt, Brace, and World. And the introduction was written by a famous, then famous linguist in America, professor of linguistics, Dr. Professor S.I. Hayakawa. And he was later known to have his own confrontation with college protesters, I believe at San Francisco State, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, because, I mean, we forget how those protesters of the 60s were also trying to tear down our institutions and how destructive those protests were.
Well, yeah, we forget that, but we also forget that the governors who took this seriously and shut them down and shut it down were amply rewarded. People don't want people don't like riots. I mean, that's the end of the that's the end conclusion here. People don't like violence, and they don't like riots, and they don't like terrorists, and whatever else they can think they have to do to pacify Detroit. I think it's at the expense of not only the larger part of that party, which I'm increasingly caring less and less about, but I think at the expense of common sense.
Completely agree. And look, the polls still show 70-80% of the American people are supporting Israel.
Yeah.
And so I know there are some loud people on certain college campuses, mostly at the expensive, I don't call them elite, the expensive schools of the Northeast and West Coast. And I know that in Dearborn, Michigan, there's a lot of protests, but the rest of the country is rooting for Israel to defeat to Hamas and the terrorists.
So, Midwestern farmers.
Get back the American hostages.
Midwestern farmers can't fly to Israel fast enough to help out. You've seen some of those videos.
Right, the cowboys, yeah. And the great people.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, to your point. Well, you and I, as members of the Jewish faith, might just take the last 10 seconds here to do something we've been working on generally, which is, you know, thanking the non-Jewish community for their support. We couldn't do it without them. I'll leave our interview on that point unless you want to say one more word.
One more word, amen.
Okay, well done, sir. Have a great you're in place of Rabbi Alush this week, so I will wish you a good Sabbath on air, and talk to you soon.
Proud to be it. Thank you.
Thank you for spending some of your afternoon with us. Bill, my producer pro tem, good to have you back in the old saddle. I hope it was comfortable for you. Thank you for sitting in for David. Portions of this show brought to you by our good friends at Y Refi. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com. Or give them a call at 888-YREFI24. They offer a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return. And it's not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. 10.25% fixed rate of return. You're in control with YRefi. You can turn your income on or off. You can compound it. There are absolutely no fees. There is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. And, of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. InvestYRefi.com. And if you don't have tickets just yet and didn't win in the free giveaway that we do every week, go to 960thepatriot.com for our Fighting for Freedom event. Mike Gallagher, Brandon Tatum, myself will have some other special guests March 26th. And until Monday, on behalf of the crew here, I'm Seth Leibson. God bless you all. And class is dismissed.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.